This interview is part two of a two-parter, and the interview is with William Grider. William Grider, he's now the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. He spent 40 years, one way or another, examining how powerful institutions interact with ordinary people. 17 years he was a National Affairs Editor at Rolling Stone. And those were the years when, as I recall, Rolling Stone had a political role to play in the culture and so on. He worked for 15 years as a national correspondent, editor, and columnist at the Washington Post and ended up assistant managing editor. And he's the author of a number of best-selling books, One World Ready or Not, about global trade, Secrets of the Temple, about the Federal Reserve, Who Will Tell the People, which was really just about how both parties were no longer really representing the people of this country. He also served as a correspondent for six Frontline documentaries on PBS, including Return to Beirut, which won an Emmy in 1985. A book just coming out this week, Meltdown, How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover, by the editors of The Nation. He wrote the introduction to that. And his next book, Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country, comes out later this month. Welcome back, William Grider.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, we, in that first interview, spent a lot of time talking about the bailout and what our hopes for it might be, the stimulus package, etc. Let me just ask a couple of more questions about that, because I think it's so much on people's minds. Do we have any idea, William Grider, what the people have gotten for their money so far? You know, does Barney Frank or Henry Waxman or Chris Dodd have any idea? And if not, are we going to find out soon?
One hopes. I mean, the short answer is no. We've not gotten, other than the sort of, I would describe as a fairly airy assurance that would have been worse if they hadn't done all the things they've done. And believe me, that ain't selling on Main Street. It's not even selling in Washington. I mean, there's these things change, you understand, day to day, week to week. But there's a high sense of feverish nervousness right now in the halls of this Congress, because they are hearing from the folks. You know, this is personal experience. I don't have a poll in front of me, but I don't think you can go to any corner of America, whether it's working class or poor people or wealthy people, where you won't run into a kind of general disgust that, oh my God, they handed all this money out and they didn't demand anything in return. That's pretty shocking to, you know, average American, assuming that the people in charge, especially when they're spending money, have something in mind to get for the money.
Yeah.
And, Terry, I think these events, the last 6 months or 9 months, have radicalized is too strong, but they have been a powerful shockwave through the American political world. And I mean people, just ordinary citizens and voters. And they saw two things. First of all, who really has power in this society and who gets taken care of instantly if they say they need it? And the other is, all of this talk about what we can afford, what we can't afford, is rubbish. You know, they can afford whatever they want to do. And I don't know where those currents are going to go, but I think they've already made the politicians nervous, because they know they don't as yet have a good answer to those questions.
Right.
And maybe Barack Obama and his team will shortly deliver to us a coherent, tell-the-truth answer. I hope so.
A couple of things that I find interesting about this. I was writing in another venue last night and was writing exactly that, that I have a feeling that the masses of Americans are in a very different state than they were 6 months ago, a year ago.
Yeah.
One of the things I sort of ask is, what questions are people asking that they weren't asking a year ago? Do you know?
And no, I think that's right.
I think it's a big thing. The other thing I was going to say is that I think almost always we are so used to a whole range of people, entities, think tanks, etc., experts saying, I've got the answer. And I don't even feel that right now there's a lot of people jockeying for I've got the answer. There's a lot of people saying, I don't think that's exactly it. That vacuum to me is really quite interesting.
In fairness to the governing elites, whom I am usually pretty hard on, we are in uncharted water. We're in an economic/political situation unlike anything in the experience of living politicians, and not to mention the public. And so for the much of the last year, the authorities, mostly George Bush and his appointees, tripped along as though they would do their deals and take care of things, and it would all turn out okay, and they really didn't have to pay a lot of attention to the public. And that includes my friends at the Federal Reserve, who have been, they're always opaque, they're always evasive, they're always cloistered and secretive, but they, I thought, were particularly indifferent to how the public was going to react to what they were doing. And they dispensed, as you know, trillions of dollars in guarantees behind the credit markets and so forth. I'm not knocking those moves, but now I think their sensibility has been altered by events, and they recognize they need to either get clearer and more honest about what they're doing or figure out a new game, because it's definitely not selling. This is dangerous territory, you understand.
Yeah.
Because at least I'm of the camp that says in this situation, only the federal government has the power and the liquidity,
the pockets,
to step up,
yeah, yeah,
and the deep pockets. And yes, it runs up deficits and debt. That's part of how you get the economy started again. The money, think of it this way, the money is frozen in everybody's pockets or bank accounts or under the bed or wherever, and the economy is contracting, and nobody has an interest in going out and buying new cars or starting factories or whatever. So the government comes in and borrows the money, whether it's from American with wealth or from China or Japan or Abu Dhabi, and it spends the money. That's what stimulus is all about, and that's the principle Keynes explained 60, 80 years ago, and it's still true. Even the conservative economists fell in on that one. They admitted, they threw up their hands, having devoted their careers to denouncing Keynes. They suddenly became converts.
Oh, yeah.
And said they were not going to stand in the way of that. Now I have to add, the Republican Party, even more narrowly right-wing than it used to be before the 08 election, thinks it's got this wonderful play that it learned from Rush Limbaugh, which is just be against everything. I think they are fatally wrong in,
yeah,
their,
it
in
seems
their politics.
Be, yeah,
we'll find out, of course, but
right,
they're betting on this guy is going to fail, and then we'll get back into control of things. And,
well, I think it's in some sense what they're doing is they're selling short politically.
Yes.
Right? In other words, they don't have a counterproposal,
no,
that has any value or has any chance. So they just figure, well, if he succeeds, we'll live with that. That's not so bad. If he fails, we'll be able to say, I told you so. And so they are actually betting for failure, which is basically Rush Limbaugh came out and said as much. Let me ask you about one very controversial item that I've heard, and I'll wrap it in another one. And that is that you have said in our earlier interview, and I've read several times, is that we need to nationalize banks and let some of them fail. In other words, that the stockholders made gambles, the companies they invested in made gambles, they made a lot of money when those gambles worked. Now, some of those companies are insolvent. And for the government, as you say, the only one that has the pockets, to invest in the insolvent ones as well as the ones that can make it is a waste of taxpayers'
yeah,
money. So that's one. Another one is that some people have advocated just nullify all credit default swaps. In other words, that's the really esoteric stuff that amounts to many times the value of all goods and services in the world. And it was this basically a casino in which Wall Street was betting on whether things were going to make it or not. There was no actually value involved. It isn't like a company goes under if they, but just say those don't work. Was anything similarly radical done in the New Deal?
Yes.
And tell us about that so people have a historical perspective.
I was being slightly playful when I wrote it this way, but those who know the history understood. When I said, well, the country needs a bank holiday, when Roosevelt came to office, the bloodletting had already been general across the country. Something like 40% of the banking system was in failure. So he didn't have to announce to people that we have problems, and unemployment was approaching 25%, et cetera. But what he did was close down the banks for, I don't know, 10 days, 2 weeks. And when they reopened, a lot of them were either transformed in their operations or under prudential regulation or liquidated. And that's what I hope that, still hope dimly, that Barack Obama would do. Because those two questions you're asking are actually intimately related. The reason I've always thought that the government has to step up and take control of the system for some period of time is so it can manage the behavior of the banks as it assists those who can be assisted, that are not gone, and it liquidates those that are gone, and that includes some very big names in American banking, starting with Citigroup. Part of why the half measures don't work is that investors who are being asked to both buy the bank stocks again or lend the money to those banks and put their money in play in the financial system know what the public has not been told clearly by the U.S. government, and that is that all of those big names, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Wachovia, Bank of America, have huge portfolios of these so-called derivatives, these credit default swaps. And that's the casino. You would be foolish if you put serious money into one of those institutions when you know that they're sitting on these time bombs. But if the government steps in and says, all right, we're in an emergency here, hold everything. First, we announce that these funny money casino derivatives are going to cease. We're going to phase them out rather quickly. Banks made a lot of money selling this paper back and forth, and now they're stuck with the danger. Secondly, we will net out these instruments, the derivatives, both buyers and sellers, the holders and the liable parties, which you can do, you know, once you've got control of everybody for a moment.
So let me
see what I mean. And this kind of transaction sounds irregular to people, but if you understand Wall Street and Wall Street finance, this sort of thing goes on rather regularly in corporations, banks, and so forth and so on. All what I'm getting at is some of this stuff you cannot really resolve unless the government steps up and asserts its emergency powers. Buying our way out of it gets you to those double trillion figures.
Right.
First of all, is outrageous. Why would we spend $1 trillion to save Citigroup? It can't be that valuable.
And isn't the other piece of it, William, this is Terry McNally speaking with William Grider. His next book is Come Home America, but we're talking right now about the current problems that are happening in America. Part of it also is that since no one wants to buy those things, so many of those derivatives and gimmicky things, it means to some extent, by the law of the jungle, they have no value. If the government says, we're going to buy them so that you can take them off your books, then we've got to value them, and then we're set with this problem. If we value them what they're actually worth, so the taxpayer doesn't get taken, it won't put enough money in to change things enough. If we value them at much more than they're actually worth, which is something close to nothing, so that we can get the credit lines moving, we will have soaked the taxpayer. So this thing of just erasing them seems to me to be a radical move that I hear from some smart people, but I don't hear the government. I haven't heard a word from the government talking about that as a possibility.
I think they're afraid to raise the subject because they haven't yet themselves decided to bite the bullet and take that real straight to the heart of the matter solution.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hunch, only. I don't know that.
This thing where we're all sitting and waiting.
Yeah, one of the very conservative bank analyst and with a firm that rates the condition of banks and knows quite a lot about the banking system had a piece the other day I read where he said what the government is doing now, recapitalizing these insolvent banks or trying to buy some of their bad assets, you couldn't afford to buy them all, is literally pouring water in a bucket that's got a hole in the bottom.
Right.
And you think about that. This is, forget ideology. This is just folly for a society to do that. I'm fairly confident, as I said previously, that sooner or later the government is going to get to the hard part and recognize that it can't do this in a sort of half gesture
right.
manner.
Right.
Unfortunately, we may have to go through another round of disappointment and failure before we get there. I hope that's wrong, but to turn to my new book for a minute, Terry, the
yeah.
Come Home America is really not written for the policy wonks and not for politicians, not even for Barack Obama. It's written for ordinary people who are now up in their seats, right? And I'm really raising the stakes for them and saying, this country is at a historic breakpoint. We're heading into a transformation, like it or not, for better or worse, that is no longer avoidable. And that goes across the range from the ecological destruction to the economic weakening of this country to globalization's effects, to militarism. I mean, I'm in a way, I'm bringing up all the subjects that nobody wanted to talk about in the last election.
Well,
except maybe a Dennis Kucinich here or there.
Right. But as I noticed when I was looking at what the new book and your last book, The Soul of Capitalism,
yeah.
how they seem departures. Because you wrote Fortress America about how much money was being wasted in defense and what the rig
right.
system
no, this
was.
Is, this is
and you wrote
of
Secrets
you.
Of the Temple about the Fed, and you wrote One World Ready or Not. It's like you took on each of these problems. But I think something that you're feeling at this, and you, Soul of Capitalism was 2004, right? So you were a little,
yeah.
but there's something where it's coming to a head for
yeah.
you, where
yeah.
the good and the bad meet, the crisis is the opportunity.
And we don't have another generation to play around with these ideas. That's part of what was driving me. That and the knowledge that if you go around the country, as I have, there are these wonderful people, some of them in quite remote places, doing their thing to work to address these problems, and without a lot of recognition or help from the government, and usually none. Next month, I'm going to go down and talk to a group called the Oklahoma Sustainability Network. These are farmers, small business people, some chemists and lawyers and scientists, and they're in the middle of the oil patch and big, massive agricultural units and so forth and so on, and they're trying to persuade their fellow citizens of Oklahoma that the country's got to change. Those are the folks I love, because talk about pioneers, talk about guts. They're standing up in the mid-politics, which is very hostile, and they are patiently, civilly trying to tell their neighbors, folks, this is serious. I could put that together with groups all over the country who need now to step up, because this sounds corny maybe, but I'm convinced that we're not going to get through these adversities and emerge on the other side as an equitable, promising society if the citizens simply leave it to the governing elites. And if people don't step up and reclaim their role as citizens, we will not be saved. And just to put it bluntly.
Yeah, that's strong. It seems that this also reminds me of, with the emergence of Barack Obama and then the questions from progressives in the left as to whether he was going too much to the center, et cetera, et cetera. What I have often said is that FDR ran on a fairly moderate platform and that it was the people, the unions, the farmers, the people who steered him to do what needed to be done. In some sense, it sounds like we're at another moment very similar to that.
I think that's right. And that's precisely the way I understand the history of the New Deal years, but also, Terry, the history of the country from the beginning. I try to evoke this in the book because I think it's so important for individual Americans to understand. The life force that has always driven this country to higher ground, whether you're talking about abolishing slavery or getting decent working conditions and wages or organizing communities and governments to do things for the public interest, always came from just folks who had the nerve to mobilize against what was usually a sort of powerful status quo. People of wealth, for sure, but also corporations and other interests that they didn't want change. They didn't want to deal with slavery or deal with civil rights afterwards, you know. And so there's a stream of history there, which in a lot of the seasons is not dominant. It's, in fact, pushed aside or suppressed or ignored. But again and again in American history, it breaks through to the surface. I call it an underground river that suddenly finds its power and comes through and changes things. That's where I think we are, literally, right at this moment. And I can't predict with any certainty that it's going to happen again now, but that's what I hope for. That's what I'm trying to coax people into considering, that this may be what has to happen if we're going to get through all this stuff, you know, without just becoming a really ugly, bitter country of people who are disappointed.
Okay, let me ask you about something which Joshua Holland in the Alternate on Tuesday had an article called "The Whole World is Rioting as the Economic Crisis Worsens. Why Aren't We?" And I'm just going to read. He says, "A depression triggered in America is being played out in Europe with increasing violence. Other forms of social unrest are spreading. In Iceland, a government has fallen. Workers have marched in Zaragoza as Spanish unemployment heads toward 20%. Riots and bloodshed in Greece, protests in Latvia, Lithuania, Hungary, Bulgaria, Russia, etc., and yet not here." And then he goes on to quote you on Democracy Now! A couple of days ago, in which you pointed out that it might come to something like that. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I understand exactly what you're asking, and it is my hope that people anywhere, everywhere, and you know, we're not talking liberals or conservatives or Republicans or Democrats, just people who, that's what I mean by claiming their citizenship. They will make their own politics. And I can't tell them exactly how to do that, but I have great confidence they can figure it out for themselves. And by that I mean, in some instances, direct action. That's what happened in the New Deal, as you know. Massive formations of direct action by citizens. We have a few bubbles of that so far. There was a sit-down strike in Chicago, a plant there where they closed the doors and threw the workers out and denied them their severance rights and so forth.
And there's a law against
that. And the workers,
they
broke the law. Not that's casually done by corporations these days. But the workers went into the plant and sat down, seized the factory, and held it until they got what they were after. There are the beginnings, including on the West Coast, as you know, of stop the foreclosures movements.
Mm-hmm.
The Nation had a terrific piece last week describing that action. I expect more of that. And I expect people to do it generally nonviolently, but these things get out of control. I'm not hoping for that. I think that's not only unnecessary, but wrong.
And counterproductive, probably.
But people can interject themselves between the sheriff, who is told by, that's his job, to run the foreclosures, right? Take the people out of their homes and put their stuff on the sidewalk where people will carry it off and deliver the empty house to the bank. That's not a process that has to roll forward. If we get enough of that around the country, the political system will respond because it won't have much choice. And if this contraction of the economy deepens, as I expect it will, the blood and injury from that process is going to get worse, not better. And people will then be out in the streets asking, where are these jobs? We heard the government was going to create jobs. Where are they? You know, I mean, this is democracy, rude and crude.
Right.
Americans are rude and crude.
Right. When we're talking about, you know, we're waiting to see what this next, you know, what the conditions on this second half of the bailout are going to be. We're waiting to see what finally passes and how quickly things happen in the stimulus. I would imagine that there are some people in those conversations that are saying, we've got so much time before
I think that's right.
People are going to turn against us.
Yeah, and the Democrats have promised a big chunk of money, $50 or $100 billion, to deal with the foreclosures. Let's see if they keep their word. Their first go-round, they said they put business in the first bailout bill, the first $350 or the first $700 billion. Please, Mr. Bankers, won't you be kind to the debtors?
Yeah, you can see we're in a pinch.
That's literally all it amounted to.
Yeah.
And they also said to the big banks, please go light on the bonuses this year, right? And, of course, the bankers just blew past all that stuff because because it wasn't a law. It was just kind of a plea.
Well, it also reminds me of that, you know, the old, maybe it's a Aesop's fable or something about the scorpion and the frog.
Exactly.
The scorpion begs the frog to ride on its back across the river. And the frog says, but you'll sting me. And he says, no, I won't. I would die too. and halfway across, the scorpion stings the frog. And he says, but we're both going to die. And he says, I can't help it. It's my nature. Giving bankers $350 billion.
With no strings.
With no strings. It's their nature.
Of course. Some of us might not be so different if we were in the banker's shoes, right? I mean, it's, you know, this is a human drama,
yeah,
comedy or whatever. But I do think this is a plus. This is part of what separates us from Eastern Europe or Russia or China, where they're rioting elsewhere. People have a kind of residual faith in the democratic process. They know its contradictions and failings. They know them quite well, but they're not revolutionary. They wanted the system to work. Secondly, they have enormous hope invested in this new president, and rightly so, I think. And I think he's totally aware that they're not just watching and cheering for him, but they want to hold him aloft. And what I've been saying in The Nation is people can help this man succeed even if his programs do not deliver the promised land by pushing him further than perhaps he intended to go, by supporting him against the hogs, and by that I think people know who I mean, and helping him break through the encrusted status quo of Washington, and that includes some members of his own party. You know what I mean? If there's a rally in the streets where people are making themselves heard and visible and hammering on their members of Congress, that strengthens Barack Obama.
Well, you know, it's interesting. They have the huge, Web 2.0 million member organization that they have actually, I've gotten emails saying, you know, okay, now we have to pressure, you know, Congress to pass a stimulus package. So in some sense, they're hoping to use it, to use that mass of people to their ends. But the other side of it is also that those people can end up actually leading them.
Absolutely.
That's what we hope. Let me ask one last thing before we wrap this up, and that is, I've just begun to read that defense might actually be in for some cuts. That defense, Mullen came out and said he wanted basically just set a rule that defense gets 4% of the GDP, you know, no matter what's going on. And
right.
That there's been pushback from, this hasn't been front page news yet, but pushback from the Obama administration saying, no, it's not business as usual for defense either. Do you have some hope there?
Well, yes, but that's a very tough fight. And the president's new budget director, Peter Orszag, I think, you know, this is standard practice. He's sent around numbers to all of the departments and saying, here's what we want you to do on your budget for next year. And the message he sent to the Pentagon was, we'd like a 10% cut. That's an opening bid, you understand, and it will get a lot of rolled around from both sides before it's anything close to final. I'm more alarmed because I know that Robert Gates, staying on as defense secretary, and Admiral Mullen, who is now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, both started pounding the tom-tom a year ago, holding joint press conferences and giving speeches saying, well, we hate to say this, but the defense budget has got to get larger after the war in Iraq is concluded. And this got, you know, inside pages of the New York Times and a few other places, but nobody was listening because we were going into a presidential campaign. But they started the campaign, and the campaign is still going forward. Now, of course, we know the defense secretary and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs will follow our president's command, right? But meanwhile, the town is filled with defense industry, the military-industrial complex, pushing a different line, which is, you ought to increase defense spending now because it will be stimulating to the economy.
Right, right. In other words,
So we're just at the opening door
right.
on this argument, and I'm not sanguine about who's going to win it.
Right.
I hope if we could get a 10% cut, that would be a start, a too modest start by my lights, but nevertheless a start. But I wouldn't bet my house on it just at this moment.
Right. Well, one of the things we know is that Chalmers Johnson mentions this in this article today, and you certainly dealt with it in Fortress America, is that there's a method to the madness of defense spending, and part of it is that you break up any program and you put factories and workers and jobs in as many congressional districts as possible. All of those people may not care about your weapon, may not care that it may never be useful, or that the war that it was designed for has long, is a piece of
invested.
History.
Yeah.
But they're invested, and they sell it as a when the economy's going well, they sell it as a jobs program.
Well,
so obviously now they will do that in spades.
I had a conversation last week with a defense expert who's a Reagan administration veteran and actually an advocate for rational reduction of the defense budget. One of his shining examples is the F-22, which is an airplane that was designed to fight Russian MiGs over the European plains. And the MiGs are long gone, and they're still building the thing, and the cost escalates because for lots of reasons, but when they cut the production order by a few planes or 100 planes, that makes every single plane cost more, right? Because you've invested hundreds of millions in the production system.
Right.
And I said,
and now you're dividing it by fewer
results.
I
said, where do they make the F-22 in Georgia? I think that's the main assembly plant. That's Lockheed Martin. And he said, well, yes, Georgia, but of course you know they make it everywhere.
Yep.
And it's not funny, actually. It's grim because I'm hoping necessity will not maybe this season, but through the next few years, will drive a new politics that actually confronts the military-industrial complex, and really, more dangerously, militarism is what I call it in my new book. Because, and I say this, this will shock people, but I say this with some sympathy to the armed services and in uniform, because they are part of this and they certainly benefit from it, but they have been led into mostly by political leaders into a series of not just wrong wars, but disastrous wars for their own well-being, and have been torn up by it. And so they have a big stake in shifting to a national defense strategy that makes sense for the country long-term, given our new conditions in the world, and that doesn't constantly put us in the face of really agitating a war that nobody had in mind until we got there. I have a pretty harsh critique of U.S. military policy here that is not fundamentally about the money, although the money obviously is part of it. It's about the risks this country is taking now in order to claim its ability to rule the world with military deployments. I mean, it's what the story Chalmers Johnson told. I tell it, I would say, quite differently, though, and on parallel furrows.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to have to wrap it up. So we've touched on a lot of it. So if I could sum up, and I'll give you like a closing statement. By that, I mean, what we're looking at is a fairly unprecedented crisis, economically, financially, and in terms of people's expectations have been.
Yeah.
And at the same time, so much of what was propping up that system had to go anyway. I'm sort of leading into your next book, Come Home America, that this is a really critical transformational moment, possibly, in the country's history.
Yeah, and I that's exactly the question I pose, which is, what do you promise people about the future when you cannot tell them, well, we're going to have endlessly more of whatever it is we want, and we will have, our margins are gone. The ecological destruction requires us to literally reorganize the mass consumption society. I mean, every product, every process of production is literally has got to change. Every building, every vehicle, and so forth and so on. This is huge just by itself. It actually is, as we know from people like Van Jones, can be an enormously creative and transformative process for the country.
Yeah.
But I try to answer that question in a way that people will find plausible. What would you offer people in exchange for this sort of wasteful, endless material prosperity?
Right.
And my answer is larger lives.
Greater quality of life, greater community.
Yeah, and I mean,
okay.
But
I think I'm going to let you go at that. So I'm Terry McNally. This has been a two-part interview with William Grider. He's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of many potent bestsellers. His next book, Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country, comes out later this month, and we look forward to it. Thank you for your time, William
Thanks,
Grider.
Terry.